On November 8th, 9 states, including California, Arizona, Florida, and Massachusetts, will have marijuana legalization referendums on the ballot. Nationwide, 57% of U.S. adults believe the use of marijuana should be made legal, while 37% say it should be illegal.
Here in Wisconsin, we see a similar trend. A recent Marquette Law School poll reveals that 59% of registered Wisconsin voters agreed that marijuana should be fully legalized and regulated like alcohol.
Joining us now is John Hudak. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. Welcome back to Central Time, John.
Thanks for having me back.
So we've got these polling numbers here, the Gallup poll that came out less than a week ago, showing that there is stronger support for the legalization of marijuana, and even compared with the presidential candidates. Can you talk us through this shift in public opinion?
Sure. The shift in public opinion has really come about because of two central reasons. The first is, I think a lot of people are looking out across the country at the four states and District of Columbia that have legalized adult use marijuana, and the 25 states and the District of Columbia that have legalized medical marijuana, and they've said, you know what, the sky isn't falling in these states. The doomsday predictions of some opponents of reform have not really fully come to fruition. And because of that, people are growing a bit more comfortable with this. Add to that, there are a lot of Americans who have experience with marijuana, not heavy users, but many Americans have experimented with it or used it on occasion, and some use it regularly, and they know what their own experience with that drug has been like. And that helps shift opinions on this issue. But what adds to that is this change in demographics in the U.S. The people who oppose legalization the most in the U.S. are people age 65 and over. The people who support marijuana reform the most are millennials. And so you have people turning 18 who have levels of support for reform around 80% or higher. And the people who are, frankly, dying off are people who have support around 35 to 38%. And so that generational replacement is leading to pretty rapid change as well.
Why do you see such a difference between the generations toward their attitude toward marijuana?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of older Americans grew up during the height of the drug war. And while some of the people in that age demographic are children of the 60s who experienced this in unprecedented ways during their youth, there were still a lot of people who were subject to government propaganda about the ill effects of marijuana. And as my book talks quite a bit about, that propaganda at times was so extreme it would suggest that marijuana use led to murder and rape and insanity and a whole variety of psychoses. And those types of culturation really stays with people over time, and it stayed with this group as well.
And heading into the elections, you know, voters have been trying to pick apart the presidential candidates and where they stand on both medical marijuana and recreational use. We found a clip, of course, of Hillary Clinton speaking during primary season at a town hall in February about medical marijuana legalization. Let's take a listen.
I want to move it from a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 2 so that we can begin to do more research. The NIH and a lot of universities can begin to try to find out, because I want you to know what we know from science. But I also want you to be able to use it while we're doing the research. And so many states, as you know, have moved to provide legal protection for the use of medical marijuana. I support that. I think that the states are the laboratories of our democracy. We should be learning about what works, what doesn't work. Different states have actually listed the kinds of illnesses and conditions that it can be used for. Are they right? We don't know. That's why we got to do the research.
So from hearing that clip, do we know today where she stands, as well as Donald Trump stands, on this issue?
I think we know pretty well what Hillary Clinton thinks about this. And while that was a long answer, she's effectively saying we need to do more research. And while I think some in the medical marijuana reform community would argue that they have all of the information that they need. They see the therapeutic effects of cannabis every day. The medical community is not there yet. The scientific community does not have that sufficient evidence yet. But she also argues, and Donald Trump does the same on medical marijuana, to let the states do as they want, to take a hands-off approach. It's really the Obama doctrine of marijuana, and that is to let states experiment, and as long as there are not, you know, tragic harms going on, let them do this while we figure out the best answers that we can.
And for scientists who are trying to do medical experiments using marijuana, they can only get this for their research from one place, I understand, from a farm at the University of Mississippi. Why is it so difficult for researchers to run experiments on marijuana to evaluate its medicinal claims?
Well, that's right. The single source of marijuana for research use comes from a farm at Ole Miss. And while the government has since lifted that monopoly, that DEA-mandated monopoly, the effects of that lifting of the monopoly have not taken effect yet. We don't have other growers around the country producing research-grade cannabis, and so still the effective policy is the single source. It's difficult for researchers to do this because, as Secretary Clinton mentioned in the clip that you played, marijuana is a Schedule I drug. That means under federal law, it is illegal in all circumstances. It has no medical value. It can't be used safely for medical use. And that means that the government puts the tightest restrictions on its use, even in research settings. And so the licensure requirements necessary for researchers who want to conduct these studies, the security requirements for the labs are tremendous and they're costly. They take years to get approval, and that creates real disincentives. It creates a real chilling effect for researchers who are considering going into this area.
We're talking with John Hudak. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. John, there has been a precedent of petitions over decades, I understand, to reschedule marijuana, to make it not a Schedule I substance. How has this petition process gone?
So the Controlled Substances Act, which is the most significant drug control law in the United States, spells out a procedure for how a drug can get rescheduled, that is, moved from one categorization to a different categorization. And there have been four petitions going through this process to try to move marijuana out of Schedule I and into some other schedule. And that petition process is a complicated one. It requires an analysis from the Drug Enforcement Agency, from the Food and Drug Administration, from the Attorney General, and that process takes years typically. Even if it shouldn't take years, it does. And even if through all of the analyses that are done on law enforcement aspects of it, on addiction and abuse potential, on medical value, even if there is a determination that it should be moved, then a whole regulatory process starts, which can also be time-consuming. For the four petitions on marijuana, however, everyone has been rejected. That is, the government has determined that there is no reason to move it out of Schedule I, and the most recent ruling on that came this August.
Why do you think that is? What is holding this back? Where is this red tape coming from?
The government will tell you that what is holding it back is the failure to demonstrate medical value. Now, this is a controversial claim. Looking just at American scholarship on this point, there is limited evidence by medical community standards of its use. But if you look abroad, researchers in a variety of countries have been doing work in this area for decades. And there is significant evidence broadly that there is medical value. I think the challenge around this policy is less the letter of the law and more the policy realities. And I've written about this on our Brookings FixGov blog as well as in my book, that, you know, The letter of the law may say if this has not cleared the hurdle for medical value, then you need to keep it in Schedule 1. But Schedule 1 makes it harder to do research on this drug. Well, there's a policy reality in this country, and that is that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans are using marijuana for medical use every day. States are allowing them to do it, and the federal government is taking a hands-off approach that effectively lets Americans do this. Well, that policy reality demands better answers for those patients, better understandings of what the medical value is, what dosing should be, what conditions it works best for, what interactions there might be or side effects there might be, what the best vehicle of delivery, whether you should smoke it or vape it or eat it or use it in a cream or a variety of other ways you can consume it. The answers need to be had because so many people are using this for medical value. And so while the government has its reason for keeping it in Schedule 1, I think a lot of people look at this and are left dissatisfied and really have a difficulty understanding why that policy continues.
We're talking with John Hudak. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Marijuana, A Short History.
And we want to hear from you. Was your DARE program effective? Do you support the legalization of marijuana? Are you a recreational drug user, or have you tried it for medicinal purposes? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking your calls now. How do you feel about the trend toward legalization and decriminalization of marijuana? That's our topic this half hour. And we're wondering if you or one of your family members have ever used medicinal marijuana. You can let us know what conversations you may have had with your children about marijuana use. You can call us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, we're picking up the conversation with John Hudak, who's the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. John, you say that there needs to be discussion around the recreational value of marijuana, that there are people who do like to get high, and this has to be something that is talked about. It's worth talking about, you say. Can you talk a little bit about this point of view?
Absolutely. In a lot of the states that have had marijuana legalization referendum for adult use, for recreational use, a lot of times the conversation is around the system being regulated better, displacing the black market, the tax benefits that can be had, and a variety of other arguments. Liberty, for instance, is a big one. And those are all important, legitimate, and serious arguments to be had on the pro-reform side. But what's interesting to me is one of the topics that people tend to shy away from, and it's true in the reform community and it's true elsewhere, is the idea that, as I write in my book, some people just like to get high. In the same way, and whether it's high to sort of a movie-style rendition of what we think of that, or whether it's someone who uses marijuana in whatever form to relax or to take an edge off or whatever it is, people enjoy using the product. Some people enjoy using the product, and that should not necessarily be seen as a harm. Some people like to have a glass of wine. Some people like to have a fancy dinner. Some people like to go out and play basketball. There's benefit to be had based on what your likes and dislikes are. And I think the culture that we've had in this country and the views around marijuana that have held for nearly a century, or frankly a century or more, is that this is inherently something that people should dislike, and that its use should only exist under very controlled experiences. While the control aspect is probably right, I think it's a disservice to act as if this is not a recreational drug for a lot of people. And frankly, a lot of people go to the polls and vote yes because they like it. And I think it speaks to what prohibition has done in terms of people being honest about their views on this product.
Well, let's hear from callers. We have Kevin from Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
What do you have to say?
Yeah, I'm fully for legalization, either recreationally, medicinally, either one. I believe actually five states have it on the ballot for recreational and four for medicinal, which has already been approved in 26 states. So just, you know, let's say all nine of these pass, that would make it 35 states out of 50. And here we are in Wisconsin, which any thoughtful person living here in Wisconsin can tell that Wisconsin has a very serious drinking problem. And yet people are still being made into full-blown criminals for possession of small amounts of marijuana. I don't believe that's right. And I would like to, I don't know if your guest knows a book I read recently called We the People. Came out, I think, last year. But anyway, the author, it was all about the legalization in Colorado and Washington.
And so what about the small amounts of marijuana, John, as Kevin talked about? Is the legal system going too far in regulating with, busting people for small amounts?
That is one of the central arguments in the discussion around marijuana reform, is that the war on drugs in this context has not worked, and that the effect of it has been that a significant number of people have faced law enforcement repercussions because of small amounts of marijuana. Now, I think there are some people who get carried away in this conversation and would make you think that anyone who's ever been charged with a marijuana crime in history has only been caught with a joint. That, of course, is not the case. We have traffickers and we have mass producers that are clearly violating what anyone would want to be the law. But there are significant numbers of people who are caught for small amounts. And even if you don't do jail time for that, you still get a criminal record out of it. And I think a lot of people think law enforcement resources are put to better use by not dealing with that situation, and that people's lives should not be upended because they are caught with small amounts of marijuana. It's something that the reform community argues quite rigorously as a need for reform, and it's something that I think connects with a lot of voters and a lot of Americans who, again, have used the drug illegally at certain times in their lives and would think back to whether it's one day in college that they did it or a period of their life where they used it, where they would hope or they would think, well, thank God a policeman didn't catch me and my life might have gone in a different direction. For a lot of people, and particularly people of color, this is the type of law enforcement incident that can really have long-term effects for them.
Let's take another caller, Shane from Beloit. Hi, Shane.
Hi there. So I just want to say I am a regular recreational cannabis user. It's something that your guest had mentioned, like used to wind down. I sort of self-medicated in a sense for anxiety and insomnia with it for a number of years. It's really helped me calm myself down and just sort of a way to level the playing field of myself mentally and just be ready for the day. And so I find it very...
Oh, I think we're losing you there, Shane. Do you see, John, a fine line between people using it for recreational and people going too far? And where is that line? Where do you cross the line?
Well, that's a great point. And I think generally a lot of people are able to use substances in responsible ways, like alcohol, like caffeine, like marijuana. Most people who use marijuana do not abuse marijuana. We know that the addiction and dependence rate is actually quite low. It's lower than it is for alcohol. And so are there people who abuse marijuana? Are there people who have clinical dependency disorders? Absolutely. And those are people who need help. Because some people will become addicted to this drug is clearly not a basis for outlawing it. If that were the case, nicotine would be illegal, caffeine would be illegal, and alcohol would be illegal as well. I think there are some people, and I've heard this in the reform community, that, well, marijuana is not addicting. It can't cause dependency. That's not entirely true. but those dependency rates are much lower than have been reported previously or have been used in, again, propaganda campaigns.
So what are the cultural shifts you're seeing in the attitudes? Where do you see marijuana in 10 or 20 years? Where, you know, what will prevail among attitudes toward marijuana?
You know, people on both sides of this issue, reformers and people who are opponents, will look out at this landscape and they will tell you the same thing. And that is, public opinion is moving in a clear direction. And if that direction has, if that public opinion has an impact on policymakers, we will see large-scale federal reform down the road. Now, attaching a time clock to that is always a risky prediction. But I think if you look 10 years into the future, you're going to see a very different landscape around this policy. You're going to see the federal government much more engaged. You're going to see an American public that is broadly supportive of it, even more broadly than the statistics, the very accurate statistics that you mentioned at the startup of this segment of 57 to 60% of Americans favoring recreational marijuana, 80% of Americans or more favoring medical marijuana. We're moving in that direction because of public opinion trends, and that is eventually going to put pressure on members of Congress. And as more millennials become members of Congress and as attitudes within Congress shift.
I'm going to have to stop you there, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that was John Hudak, a senior fellow at Brookings Institution and the author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History.